Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
We scientists have now located a gene which we scientists believe is a big step forward in our quest to show that every bit of human behavior can be explained away mechanically.
Neuroscience has looked deep into the brain.
It's found neurons and neural transmitters galore.
But it hasn't found a will that is free.
Could freedom really be just an illusion?
Free will is sometimes an illusion.
Our guest is Daniel Dennett, author of Freedom Evolves.
If neuroscience can predict what we're going to do, are the neuroscientists going to share their predictions with us in advance?
Freedom of choice is what you got. Freedom from choice is what you want.
My brain made me do it. Well, what would you want to make you do it?
Neuroscience and free will, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the campus of Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon, part of their 19th annual undergraduate philosophy conference.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner down south at the Stanford University campus. That's where Ken here teaches philosophy and where I taught philosophy for 40 years.
And quite well, I have to say. So welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Now, today we're thinking about neuroscience and free will.
As our knowledge of the human brain grows, some neuroscientists have come to the shocking conclusion that there's no such thing as free will, that it's just all an illusion. Frankly, Ken, I don't buy it.
You don't buy it? Come on. What are you, some kind of Cartesian dualist stuck in the 16th century? You think the mind is free because it's not part of material nature or something like that?
No, I'm not a dualist, just the opposite. The mind is just a part of nature. It's basically the brain, the central nervous system. It's physical. But you know, we philosophers have been dealing with the problem of free will for centuries.
Without much progress, you have to admit, our brethren haven't made much progress.
No, I don't admit that at all. I think philosophers have made all kinds of progress, clarified the concept, come up with interesting theories of freedom and responsibility. Neuroscientists just ignore what philosophy has to say. And as a result, they made a complete hash of things.
Come on, John. Neuroscience is really cool. It's shown us some really surprising and personally, I think, quite disturbing things about the nature of the free will. And these disturbing things are the things that philosophy could never have anticipated on its own.
Yeah, like what?
Oh, cool. Well, like neuroscience shows us. Well, here's an example that the brain, you know, actually decides what we're going to do before we're consciously aware that we've even made a decision.
And that shows us what about freedom of the will?
Well, it shows that it's an illusion, John. Look, yeah, admittedly, we have this subjective impression that our decisions are somehow entirely up to us. But you know, it's really all done by the brain without a sliver of our conscious awareness.
I think you're somewhat alienated from your brain, Ken. I mean, it's really part of you. You've been reading too much Benjamin Libet.
I have been reading Libet, and that's groundbreaking work. I mean, he did this cool experiment a while ago. He measured his subjects' brain activity while they repeatedly pressed a button at random intervals. Okay? Now, the subjects were asked to make a note on a clock when they first became aware of their own intention to press the button. And you know what he found? He discovered that a couple of hundred milliseconds before the subjects became aware of their intentions to press the button, before they even formed that conscious intention to press a button, their brains were already preparing the finger to move. That's really amazing.
Somehow it doesn't amaze me. I like to leave a lot of stuff up to my brain, including moving my fingers most of the time. On the basis of this little teeny experiment, Libet drew the wildly implausible conclusion that free will is an illusion and that consciousness plays no role in what we decide to do, not just in movements of our little fingers, no role at all, except possibly to veto decisions already made by the unconscious.
Why wildly implausible?
Well, I hate to break it to you, but Libet's experiments are totally irrelevant.
How could you say that?
Well, first of all, brains don't make decisions. People do. Second, we don't need Libet to tell us that our brain, of course, is involved in our decision-making somehow or another. Who would deny that? And besides, his experiments tell us next to nothing about how exactly the brain and consciousness are involved in decision-making.
Okay, look, take more recent experiments by Chun Soon and colleagues. What do you think about this? They were able to accurately predict a so-called free choice up to 10 whole seconds, John, before their subjects were even aware of their own choice.
Big deal. I'll make a prediction right now. Tomorrow night, if you have a choice, you won't take the beaten kale salad for your main course. Whoa, who knew it? How can I do that? It must be magic. Mental events have antecedent causes. They're just like every other event in nature. Decisions don't just happen randomly in some vacuum.
Gretchen, why are you being so sarcastic? Why the sarcasm?
Because unlike what you seem to be assuming, being free is not being uncaused. As compatibilists like Hume argue, that is, people who think that freedom is compatible with determinism and causation, free actions are caused. They're caused. But the ones that are free are the ones that are caused by our own beliefs and desires. Of course our decision-making is enmeshed in a network of inner and outer causes. Freedom is a distinction made within that. So showing that something played a role in causing a decision couldn't possibly do anything to undermine the reality of free will.
I see what's going on. I see what's going on here. You're citing the authority of Hume, but he was a piker compared to Kant. Kant said compatibilism is a wretched subterfuge. It's a cheat. It's an attempt to have your free cake and eat your deterministic causation too. It won't work, John.
I think if you have cake, eating it is quite reasonable. Now I understand your fetish for neuroscience. You start off with this libertarian, that's libertarian with a little L, not a political position, just a wacko position, notion of freedom. You think that real freedom requires some kind of crazy non-physical causality. You're the Cartesian. So, of course, neuroscience threatens to upset your Cartesian apple cart because it finds only physical causes, doesn't find mysterious causes. But who cares? Who takes that libertarian freedom seriously anymore? Neuroscience, apparently, hasn't gotten the news.
I'm not sure it's so cut and dry. I mean, you're saying if you're a libertarian, well, then you should worry about neuroscience. But if you're a compatibilist like John, you needn't worry. You just can stick your head in the sand. You know, I'm not willing to concede that. But I am going to admit there's a lot more to think about here.
To give us even more food for thought, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari. We sent her out to find out what we can learn about how our choices are really caused by looking at the psychology of magic. She files this report.
I'm going to flip through this deck, and I want you to see one card, and not this one. That's too obvious.
Pay close attention.
We've all seen magic tricks before. You see a card from a deck, and some magician always knows which card you're thinking about. It's like they're reading your mind. Of course they're not. They're just manipulating your choices.
I can't share the secret of this trick, but I can talk about the principle behind it, in that I'm trying to influence their decision without their awareness.
That's Jay Olson, a professional magician and a grad student in psychiatry at McGill University in Montreal. Olson took a classic card trick and conducted a psychological study to understand why people think they have free will in situations where they're clearly being influenced. In the study, Olson exposes people to one card in the deck more than the others. It's called forcing, and it's a way to control people's selections, whether that's a card, a number, a letter.
Magicians have been doing forcing for quite a while, although we don't really understand why it works. We don't really understand why magicians can influence people so well without them noticing that influence. So we figured that we could study this feature of magic using the tools of psychology.
98% of the participants in the study chose the card that Olsen wanted them to pick, but only 9% realized he was affecting their choices. They thought they had the free will to pick the card they wanted. And it's not just magic tricks. Olsen says this happens every day.
So if somebody gently taps your shoulder when they're making a request, you're more likely to comply to that request. Or sometimes if people slightly rush your decision, then you'll be more likely to choose some particular options over some other ones.
Like at a restaurant. A study from Cornell University shows people spend more money when menus don't include the dollar symbol next to the price. People are also more likely to buy the first or last menu item because it attracts the most attention. But when asked, people always say they order something because that's what they want. Think about that the next time you buy a $40 filet mignon.
I think what we're finding more and more in psychology is that a bunch of the decisions that we make throughout life are heavily influenced by situational factors.
Does this mean we don't have free will? Olsen says that depends on your definition.
When you just ask people casually on the street what they mean by free will, in some studies they found one of the core components that they often mention is that the decision is relatively free from influences. So they're not being coerced or they're not being highly persuaded.
But we are being highly persuaded, quite often. Of course, that doesn't mean free will doesn't exist at all. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Olsen says that's way beyond the scope of his study.
I would say, though, that this feeling of a free choice or this feeling of a free will that we have doesn't necessarily match the situation.
But it doesn't have to be that way. Olsen says the takeaway is to pause before making big choices. If we don't rush into our decisions, we're less likely to be affected by situational factors and more likely to have some semblance of free will. Or at the very least, we won't be tricked into buying a $40 steak just because it's at the top of the menu. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
I'm John Perry. Thanks for that interesting investigation into magic free will. I'm here along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford. I'm watching my words carefully so I'm not overly influenced by Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon.
Now, our guest today is a professor of philosophy from Tufts University, where he's also co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies. He's a really prolific author, including, relevant to our talk today, Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage the one and only Daniel Dennett.
So, Dan, many years ago when we first met in 1968-69, you were already a published author, as I remember. You'd published Content and Consciousness. And with all the different things you've done, consciousness, the mind, that's a thick thread through all
oh,
of
yes.
your work.
Absolutely.
But you're good at a lot of things. You could have been a neuroscientist yourself. Why was philosophy so lucky that you chose us?
I think it's because I was better at the questions than the answers.
Oh, I see. Well, you've provided a lot of answers over the years.
Well, I have.
A couple of them have been fairly plausible.
Oh, yeah. Those are the ones that are weak, you know. The good ones are the ones that are really counterintuitive.
Okay. I'm pretty skeptical about some of these sweeping claims neuroscientists make about free will. Which is not to say that they don't do a lot of good work or that the brain is unimportant or that neurons are unimportant or anything like that. But when they say something like conscious will is just an illusion, my problem is I can't bear to read how they defend this. So I don't really know what they have in mind. But you've got this willpower. You read all these things. Can you take us into the mind of a neuroscientist who thinks that because I'm not conscious of which way I'm going to twitch my finger before my brain decides to twitch my finger that I don't have free will? How are they thinking of things?
Well, that's a good question, John, because I think they haven't thought very carefully about the philosophical underpinnings of what they're doing. They take their concept of free will from the man in the street, from something they read when they were in high school or who knows when, And so they tend to be, to think that what free will is making decisions that aren't caused, that aren't caused by anything. So if determinism is true, or even roughly true about the brain, then they think that shows there's no free will. That's simply a crazy idea.
Some years ago, you wrote a very readable book, about 120 pages, called Elbow Room.
Yeah.
What more can we do?
Wait a minute, guys. You diss the neuroscientists for taking their concept of freedom from the person on the street. Well, who are they supposed to take it from? You two guys? You guys, look.
Freedom,
notion of freedom is part of what Sellers calls the manifest image. It's part of our common sense furniture. We've had it for a long, long time. And if the guy on the street is a libertarian about freedom, because that's how it appeals to us, the neuroscientist isn't a fool for taking the concept of freedom over from them and then showing that, well, that concept doesn't quite apply.
Well, what do you mean?
There's two features of the everyday notion, the manifest image notion of freedom, and they have been in tension for 2,000 years and more. One of them is the libertarian idea of absence of causation, and the other one is it's a necessary condition for moral responsibility. And it's the second one, which is the important one, I think. And that's just as much a part of the manifest image as the other. So I think it is true that the manifest image has made a mistake, and has made a mistake for several thousand years, going way back to Democritus, on the absence of causation.
So neuroscientists are doing something good to be applauded. They're either correcting the manifest image, right, or they're saying the manifest image has something deeply wrong and needs to be revised, and somehow we better revise it.
And you know what? One of the ironies is that the scientists turn to the philosophers who are least interested in science, who know no science, who don't care about science, and those are the ones they go to for their view of free will. And no wonder they say that it's an illusion.
Well, okay, we're going to have to dig into this. I don't really want to hold a brief for the libertarians and the manifest image, but I feel like I need to. This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. Our guest is Daniel Dennett from Tufts University.
Has neuroscience shown that there's no such thing as a free choice? Could it ever show this? What can neuroscience tell us about the problem of free will?
Free choice, the illusion of conscious will, and neuroscience, along with questions from our free and conscious audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Daniel Dennett from Tufts University, and we're thinking about neuroscience and free will.
Does a subjective feeling of freely choosing show that you really have free will? Do you think it's possible to be mistaken about how you can make decisions? Could neuroscience ever convince you that you're not free? You can join the discussion by stepping up to the microphones in front of the stage.
So, Dad, I want to ask you. Okay, so we were trying to get into the neuroscientist's head. I think I know the answer to that. I know what John thinks, and I think I know pretty clearly what you think, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How seriously should we take these claims from the neuroscientists about how we make choices? I mean, do you think they show anything to the effect that free will is an illusion? I mean, all this stuff that we don't know the real causes, the causal correlates of our behavior.
Actually, I don't think the neuroscientific experiments show much of anything of interest. They're interesting theoretically, but they don't show anything about free will that matters. The magician and some psychologists that work on things like psychological forcing, now that's where it gets more interesting.
So why do you think the psychological forcing stuff is more relevant or more interesting than the neuroscience stuff? What's wrong with the neuroscience stuff? I mean, neuroscientists are fond of saying they've shown that free will is an illusion.
So they are, but their experiments only show what, in reflection, you should realize is obvious. You know, somebody says, my brain made me do it. Well, what would you want to make you do it? I want my brain to make me do it. And the only thing that's at all striking is that it turns out there are patterns in your brain under some conditions but only very weird and special conditions where a so-called prediction can be made. Let's take the Soon article that you mentioned. First of all, the examples of free choices that started with Libet and that others have done are bizarre examples because they are deliberately chosen as choices which don't mean a thing. They are supposed to be absolutely arbitrary on sheer whim. Just when the spirit moves you, push the left button, push the right button, flick your wrist. Nothing hangs on them. So they are deliberately drained of all meaning and all purpose. Well, now, suppose I ask you, Ken, all right, right now, give me a string of 8 random numbers. Quick, quick, quick.
6, 7, 9, 12, 16, 32.
All right, so hard to do.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, people are bad at that. And how did you do it? You don't know. But who knows whether those, what happened in your brain started 10 minutes ago.
So the thing that Libet et al. Study, isn't that sort of paradigmatic intentional action? I mean, because free actions are intentional actions. They're not just randomly caused things. They're things done for reasons, for purposes. And so if you say, well, I'm interested in some doings that people, but not they're not intentional, reasoned, of course we don't know what the story's about.
Now, but back to the magic again. We all know the game rock, paper, and scissors. If you ever get in a situation where somebody's just got your number and they're winning and winning and winning and winning, it's very spooky because apparently in those cases you see that somebody really is either anticipating your choices very well or in some subtle way manipulating you. And that's what magicians are actually very good at. And there's been an arms race of sort of covert manipulation that human beings have been engaged in, you know, since the Stone Age.
Okay, are you willing to say on the basis of that kind of study? Because there, you're right, there are tons of studies that show that all these things seem to be controlling our behavior, of which we're entirely unaware. And when we offer an explanation of why we did what we did, it's mostly confabulation and it's missing all this. Does that help convince you that free will is an illusion?
No, it convinces me that free will is sometimes an illusion, because some people set out to manipulate other people. Knowing that, if you know that you are a target of manipulation, you can, and if you know the latest stuff about what's being done, you can fend this off. And that is actually an important part
of
your freedom.
Someone's dying to get in here.
Yeah, I want to go back to the end of the first session where you guys were distinguishing the manifest image and the scientific image. I think it's a very good distinction. The language comes from Sellers. Good example is solidity. There's really three things involved. We have a term, solid. We make distinctions all the time between liquids and solids. We put these distinctions to good use. We have the word solid. It's been part of the human vocabulary since humans had a vocabulary. Then there's a picture of solidity that we have that turns out not to be right. It turns out that things that we think of as solid are, at the microscopic level, have big spaces in between. And so the scientific image is different from what's called the manifest image. But that third thing, the actual working concept, really was formed in innocence of the scientific image, and it's pretty independent of the manifest image. Now, it seems to me that when we think about free will, the key term is not solidity, but can. We have this word can. We use it all the time. Incompatibles say that I can't convince Dennett of anything, right? And I think the mistake is not looking at the manifest image. It's interesting to say some things about it. Mostly it comes from Christianity. It didn't really exist till St. Augustine worried about why God was so mad at Adam when he created him. But the word can, I'm sure it's been around since words were around. And I think when you say we don't have free will, the cash value of that is that when we say I did this but I could have done that, it's false. And that's what the neuroscientists haven't touched.
I think this is deep and right and important because, and Dan sort of hinted at this because he just said there were two things. He talked about moral competence and something else.
Independence of causation.
Independence of causation. And the moral competence is obviously there. And I think abilities are obviously there. And but I think what the manifest image did and what philosophy did for some is kind of merge these things together that are separable. And one of the things science, not just neuroscience, but psychological science, is helping us to show is, oh, these two things don't necessarily go together. Now, what do we do about the concept? You know what I think? And I don't know why you don't think this, because you think this in so many domains. Oh, let the old concept go. Who cares? Let's start new. Let's have better concepts. That's what science does. It gives us better concepts.
You can junk the word free will if you want. I don't use it. I give it to Augustine. You can even junk the word free if you want, although I don't think we need to do that. But let's not junk the word can.
Oh, I totally agree with you.
Cannot.
I totally agree.
And the idea, if I get home and I brought home whole milk instead of skim milk, and my wife is mad at me, and I say, they were out of skim milk, I couldn't get any.
I totally agree.
That I ought to be treated differently than if I say, well, they had it, but it was kind of on a high shelf, and I would have had to reach.
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about neuroscience and free will in front of a live audience at Pacific University at the 19th Annual Undergraduate Philosophy Conference. And we've got some questioners from that live and autonomous and free and conscious audience, I think. And we'll start. I'll go back and forth. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Big Daddy Bauer. I'm from Boise State University. My question is simply this. Is it maybe that in a compatibilist framework, we have free will in certain things and not in others? And in the compatibilist framework, if we don't have free will, could we know it?
Is that like being a little pregnant? What is free will in certain things but not in others?
I think that's a very good question, because we obviously have variable free will. Sometimes we're overcome with emotion, we're overcome with gluttony, with an obsession, with whatever. And we recognize that in ourselves. We recognize it's a human problem. And in fact, one of the interesting things to me about free will in this area is that over the centuries, we've invented helps, prosthetic aids to improve our free will. For instance, and we all know them, it's, you know, don't buy the junk food and have it in the house because you won't be able to resist it if it's there. Or one of my favorites is the farmer who drops a quarter down the outhouse when he's pulling up his pants, and he swears and throws a $5 bill down after the quarter. And somebody says, why are you doing that? He says, you don't think I'm going down there for a quarter, do you?
That's called volitional engineering.
Yeah, exactly.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Mehmet Vurkaç. I teach electrical engineering at Oregon Institute of Technology in Klamath Falls. A couple of minutes ago, you said something about throwing out the old concept, and I wonder what your take or your various takes might be on Gazzaniga, I think is the name, neuroscientist who...
Gazzaniga?
Yeah. Okay. Never heard him say it. In one of his books, he says something like, what would you want your will to be free from? And he seems to continue to say that the question of do we have it or not is a bit pointless. You know, he kind of goes into the idea of emergence a little bit, and he seems to be taking a third path. What do you think?
I'm glad you raised Michael Gazzaniga, because I exempt him from my blanket criticism of neuroscientists. He is one neuroscientist who's thought hard about this and has gathered legal scholars and philosophers around and had run workshops, and his writing on this topic is adroit and careful, and he knows better than to make the mistakes that a lot of others do.
But then I want to try something else out on you. You've written a lot about the self. You say the self is the center of narrative gravity, right? And that's supposed to mean centers of gravity are kind of fictional calculational devices. So you're not, I mean, it sort of exists as an abstractum, but it's not really real. Neuroscience or the psychology of the mind or something has helped convince you of that. Can you tell me about, you have this multiple drafts theory of consciousness that you contrast to the Cartesian theater and all that. You don't believe in qualia, you don't believe in the self, you don't believe in consciousness as many people understand it. So what's the big deal about giving up on freedom? Why don't you just give up on freedom too?
Well, sometimes I think that that's the thing to do. Just the term is so bandied about, and I'm tired of talking about how to define the term. So recently I've been experimenting with just saying, let's just talk about moral competence instead. And that's what, to me, is the heart of free will anyway. And, of course, we use the term free will. When I signed a legal document recently, the notary asked me, did you sign that of your own free will? And I knew just what she was asking, and I said yes.
So I think, John, you have a view kind of like this, too, because you say you can have a bunch of it, but don't take away my can.
No. I would say the two of you are barking up the wrong tree. You should treat self like I want to treat can. Self's a perfectly good word, makes perfectly good sense. Myself is me, the person, the live human being. You know, I say I'm going to do it myself. I don't say that some inner principle is going to do it or some fictional narrative, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I'm going to do it. The word I doesn't stand for something inside. It stands for me. Now, if St. Thomas Aquinas and Ludwig Wittgenstein and Miss Anscombe want to say that that's wrong, they're wrong. Don't give them our words. Keep our words.
Well, I didn't give up the self. I said, here's what a self is. It is not an organ of the brain, and you don't think that either.
No, I think it's you. It's all of you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in fact, the most important sentence in Elbow Room was one I put in parentheses, stupidly. It was, if you make yourself really small, you can externalize virtually everything.
Oh, well.
Welcome to Philosophy Dust.
That's a deep thought.
Hey, I'm Trevor from Boise State University. And my question was, if we're supposed to be okay with the brain being the cause of some actions, but the brain is just basically physical and matter and particles, unless the brain is made up of particles that somehow move or behave differently for some reason, why isn't the old incompatibilist line that the laws of physics and the past, since we can't control them, do cause our actions today?
Well,
why would you want anything else to cause your actions?
Yeah, what's so bad about that?
Well, because he's nodding at the consequentialist argument, and we shouldn't just have a love fest about compatibilism, right. So I'll push the consequence argument, right? So you can't change the laws of nature. Right. You can't change facts about the past. Facts about the past and laws of nature entail what you're going to do next if determinism is true. So if you were to do other than what you do, either the laws of nature would have to be false or the facts about the past would have to be false. You can't do anything about those. Therefore, you can't do anything other than you're going to do, right?
Yeah, that's what they say, and that seems true enough. But you know what, though?
Seems true enough.
That seems true enough.
And I have a short answer, which is, so what?
Yeah, because I'll have a long version of the so what. Because the way the facts about the past and the laws cause me to do what I do is by causing me to... A whole bunch of things happen. I have beliefs. Part of that having beliefs is a change of reasoning. Sure, those chains of reasoning are causal events in my head, but nothing that doesn't result from a chain of reasoning in my head is my action. And how else would my actions be?
But you haven't answered the argument. We got the word can. You say, well, I can do this. I'm not going to do this, but I can do this. So we got two possible worlds there. We got the actual world, which is the world in which the things entailed by the laws of nature in the past happen. And we got another possible world, which you're somehow using to describe your ability. Where does that possible world come in? In that possible world, either the laws of nature are violated or the past
I'm
facts
gonna pull
are different.
A John Locke
How do
on
you get yourself into that possible
I'm gonna
world?
I'm going to pull a John Locke on you, but I'm going to do it after a break. Because I think John Locke solved this one a long time ago, and then Harry Frankfurt got credit for it several hundred years later. But I'll remind folks that you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about neuroscience and free will with the one and only Daniel Dennett, author of many things, including Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking.
What difference does it make whether or not we have free will? We can still hold people morally responsible for their actions if there's no free will. Matter of fact, we'll have to because determinism says we will.
We're coming to you from the 19th Annual Undergraduate Philosophy Conference at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. We'll take more questions from our free, autonomous, conscious thinking audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Daniel Dennett from Tufts University. And we're thinking about neuroscience and free will. And before we go, I want to try something on John. okay? Because he said, oh, the can, you haven't answered the consequence argument. And Dan said, so what? And I'm going to give a longer so what, but I'm going to borrow it from John Locke. Suppose you're in your study, in your room, smoking your opium, drinking your steak, sitting by a fire, having a grand old time, and you think, should I get up and leave this room? Nah, I think I'll stay here. I think I'll stay here. Did you stay there freely? I told you a lot of stuff, but I didn't tell you the next thing. The room is locked. If you had gotten up to leave the room, you couldn't have left the room. You could not have done otherwise. Did you stay in the room freely, John? Yes, you stayed in the room freely. You stayed in the room of your own free will. You're smoking your opium. You're having a good time.
I'm hesitating because you've got Locke wrong. Locke said, are you morally responsible for staying in the room? Are you morally... If something is happening out... So you're sitting in a room and you hear somebody being beaten outside and you think, I should get up and do something about that, but screw it. You might say, well, we hold him morally responsible, but it turns out the door was locked. He couldn't have done anything anyway. Well, we still hold him morally responsible. So to be held morally responsible, it doesn't have to be the case that you could have done something other than you did. But the question I'm interested in, I mean, moral responsibility is just fine, but I want to claim that we often, in spite of determinism, can do things different than we did. We don't live in a room of locked doors.
And oddly enough, I think the can concept we need is one which really sort of comes from engineering, and it's degrees of freedom. If you have a robotic arm with 4 degrees of freedom, that means it can move in 4 different ways, and you got to control all 4 of them. And the idea of degrees of freedom is a non-metaphysical, perfectly sound idea, and it applies to us too. Well, and if you've got free will, it's because you control the degrees of freedom that matter.
So you guys are confusing me a little bit. Okay, the consequence argument...
We can't help it.
Yeah, because I'm confused. Yeah. The consequence argument is supposed to show that somehow determinism, the laws of the facts together strip us of certain abilities. So it's the ability to do otherwise.
I think,
wait a minute, what does it really... if I raise my hand, I'll let the condemned man go. But I don't raise my hand. I decide to keep it down, and the condemned man dies. What did the laws do? Well, I didn't want to let the man go. So I didn't have the motivation to let the man go. I had the opportunity to let the man go. I had the ability to raise my hand, because look, I can raise my hand, right? So when the universe strips me of... What did the universe strip me of in the consequence argument? It seems to strip me of the motivation. But stripping me of the motivation, does that strip me of my abilities?
Well, I can't argue with your intuitions, but I mean, the way the consequence argument works is, so here, I got my hand. If I raise my hand, the man will be set free. Now, Dennett would say, and I would agree with him, that you got to separate the general ability to raise your hand, which I have. A person who was paralyzed, didn't have an arm, wouldn't. Then there's the opportunity. The circumstances are such that if I raise my hand, it will have a certain effect. Given those two things, the compatible says I can free the guy. The incompatible says no. In fact, I'm not going to raise my hand. Could be predicted, if determinism is true. It was already settled years ago by the laws of nature and that. And so that I have the general ability, I don't have the specific ability in this case to free the guy. Now, I think it's a serious argument. I don't happen to think it works, but I think it's a serious argument.
It's determined from the beginning of the universe that I don't have the motivation to raise my hand. Not that I don't have the ability to raise my hand. But you know what? Let's listen.
You're just appealing to compatibilism.
Yeah,
I think what you're really is semi-compatible. It's like John Fisher.
But. Yes. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, I'm Clint from beautiful North Idaho College, and my question is, in the deterministic sense, is it possible to learn anything at all?
Well, if John's an example, yes.
You know, I'm glad you asked that, because every now and then you find a philosopher who sort of should know better, who thinks, you know, if determinism is true, then my hopes are constrained. No, if determinism is true, then... You know, can you teach an old dog new tricks? Well, maybe you can and maybe you can't. It all depends. Maybe determinism shows that you can teach old dogs new tricks.
Determinism is pretty loose about what happens.
I want to ask you 2 old dogs then. So do you think Kant just was flapping his lips when he called compatibilism a wretched subterfuge?
Yes.
I mean, do you think there's anything to that that thought?
No, I think he was about as wrong as a philosopher can be. But even more impressive, William James called it a quagmire of evasion.
Yeah.
I'm writing a book on this, and I'm calling it Wretched Subterfuge, but quagmire of evasion might be a good title, too.
There's a female voice for the first time. Welcome to Philosophy Talk now.
Thank you. I'm Caitlin from Lewis and Clark College. So if neuroscience did show that all our actions could be predicted before we decided to do them, and so seemed to indicate that we didn't have free will, do you think it would impact society beyond philosophy at all, or is it just far too useful for us to think and act as though we have free will, and so we always will?
Well, there's a lot packed into the ifs there. First of all, if neuroscience can predict what we're going to do, are the neuroscientists going to share their predictions with us in advance? And think about what that does. This is actually a subtle point. If they're going to publicly predict what we're going to do, then they have to calculate the effects of their public prediction on us. And that turns out to be an intractable problem. They can't do it. So there's a certain sense in which even if determinism is true, and even if they can gather the evidence, they can't tell us.
Yeah, because there's a little puzzle there. Right? I mean, because it looks like if you predict my behavior, right, and then you tell me your prediction, I can confound your prediction. That seems to, I don't know what that suggests. Is that consistent with determinism, or is it not? It seems to me like I can always confound your prediction. You say, you're going to swerve left. Well, okay, then I'll swerve right.
You know, there's a similar point that a brilliant philosopher whose name is escaping me for a moment, but she's back at Johns Hopkins. Even in your own deliberation, if you had some kind of magic thing that said what you were going to do or what you were determined to do, it wouldn't help that much. What you really have to do is think things through, abstracting from your desires, looking at your general abilities and circumstances, and then and only then go to your desires. And if you think about that, that's compatibilism.
So I want to say, I haven't really said my own view, but I want to say it briefly. I actually think freedom is a red herring, and I think. But I see. I was trying to get both of you guys to agree with me subtly, but you won't, right?
Cause, no way.
Because I think you're both under. I don't know who gets to keep the concept freedom. Who gets to keep the word? If you gave the analysis of our ordinary talk of freedom, but in our ordinary talk of freedom, so many things go together that can be separated and have to be separated, and they don't, it's just like your view about qualia, they don't form, so freedom in that sense doesn't exist. Now, what does exist? Some kind of control, and blah. Does that deserve to be called freedom? I don't know, but it's real, and it's worth thinking about, and if we were starting from scratch, we'd invent a concept to cover exactly that without all this other baggage. Well, so why not think of freedom as a kind of a red herring?
Well, but certainly freedom, as Hume says, the opposite of freedom is not necessitation, but coercion. And that concept of freedom, whether the man on the street has it right or not, that's an important concept.
Political freedom, in effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Welcome to Philosophy Talks here.
Hi there. I'm Craig from Thompson Rivers University in Kamloops, British Columbia, Canada. And I was just curious. It's always seemed to me that the idea of the self and the idea of free will are closely linked. So can we have a self without the concept of free will?
That's a good question for Dan Denner, who sort of tempted to at least revise the concept of the self.
That's what a self is. A self is what does those actions. Just think about something very simple for the moment. Think about looking at yourself in the mirror. How do you know that's you? Because you know what you look like? No, but because you can go like this and watch the mirror reflection do the same thing. It's because you know what you are doing, and you know that you can perform these actions in the world, and when you see the mirror image perfectly in sync with it, that's how you know that you're looking in a mirror. And I think that right there we see that self-recognition and the capacity, the can-do, as John says, to act and to choose to act, are really very tightly linked.
Well, welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, I am Kenny from Pacific University. And I have a simple question in the respect of like intentions. You know, I intend to raise my hand, and it appears I have the belief that I do this willingly, of my own volition. So my question is, How do you define a belief, or each of you or all of you?
That's not going to get on the air, you know.
That's, I got an answer, but it's too long.
It's too long. That's too long. Ask us afterwards.
A belief is an internal state that motivates an action in conjunction with a desire that will satisfy the desire if the belief is true.
Now that's a
pretty good.
That's a radio-worthy answer. Dan, this has been a great conversation. I wish we could continue, but we've got to draw it to a close, and I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it very much.
Our guest has been Daniel Dennett. He's a professor of philosophy and co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies at Tufts University. He's a very prolific author. He's an author relevant to this discussion of intuition pumps and other tools for thinking and many other great reads. So, John, what are you thinking now? I know you're a harder compatibilist. But
oh, I'm a compatibilist, and it always worries me. Dan's written two books on free will, The Short and Elegant Elbow Room and the longer book on the evolution and freedom. And I wonder, do I have anything to say in
yes.
addition to what he's already been made clear? And the answer I always come up is, well, I'm not writing this book because I think I have something new to say. I'm writing this book because before I die, I want to get straight in my own mind what the answer to all those problems that pushed me into philosophy are. And if somebody else wants to read it, that's fine.
but
he's one great philosopher.
No, he is one great philosopher. He's a great conversationalist. And, you know, I'm pretty much a compatibilist, but I'm really serious that I think freedom is a red herring. We get wrapped up in all these debates because, you know, all this stuff is mushed together. I like philosophy that just starts inventing concepts anew, just like science starts over. You're not moved by that kind of thought?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. I mean, it's understanding how these red herrings have managed to create culture and help us fend with reality, and even worse, under people for millions of millennia. That's what interests me.
Well, we differ in that way. This conversation we'll continue at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, now get this, cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog, for those of you who don't speak Latin. And you too can become a partner in our community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now we peer into the synapses of a fast-talking free agent. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I've never quite understood what is meant by free will. I assume it means that you make a decision to act unencumbered. But unencumbered by what? We are all of us encumbered. I mean, say you want to buy an ice cream cone on a hot summer day. Already, your free will has been compromised. You're not buying an ice cream cone in a vacuum. The desire for the ice cream cone has been triggered by the hot summer day, the effects of which you wish to both mitigate and enhance by the act of eating ice cream. And what kind of ice cream? You know what you want, chocolate, vanilla, butterscotch, but what you want has been ordained. You have a history of ice cream eating, perhaps a joyful history, perhaps a tragic history seasoned by memories of ice cream headaches, the despair of settling for a sugar cone when you had your heart set on the waffle and they didn't have one. Perhaps you're even lactose intolerant, but are willing to swap the intestinal discomfort to come for the momentary joy of the lick. Joy, then lingering despair. That's why you chose to be a vegan. Wishing to replace the ice cream with a fruit smoothie. You can do that, of course, but it will leak all over the cone. And everyone will laugh at you, not only because you're a vegan at an ice cream stand, but a sticky vegan, which presumably you chose to become of your own free will. But again, did you? To conquer your lactose intoleranceness, maybe you were hypnotized by your therapist to become vegan. But he left a post-hypnotic suggestion that you wouldn't remember. It could happen. How would you know? You don't remember. They say you can't be hypnotized to do something against your will, but how would you know that, especially if you've forgotten being hypnotized in the first place? And especially, as we have seen, free will is already hampered by your massive character flaws. But forget all that, if you can. Forget all that. Do you even have the willpower to do without your ice cream? When it's 90 in the shade, the ice cream truck's bells are tinkling, coming nearer and nearer, your exact change is clutched in your sweaty hand. How do you even know the ice cream truck is real? What if it's a trick by a confidence man to get all your spare change and leave you sweating on the curb with nothing but a cheap soy substitute dripping on your T-shirt? See where your free will got you? On the other hand, does the con man have free will when he made the choice to rob you of your money in exchange for counterfeit ice cream? Was that money worth your pain? Or are we all just trapped in an endless cycle of volition and thwarted desire, momentary pleasures and regret? Can you even get butterscotch ice cream anymore? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Dave Borsma, Wendy Stein, Tal Sanders, Elise Elliott Foundation, and the Philosophy Department here at Pacific University.
Thanks also to Joel Groves and Kevin Hasenkopf.
The program is produced by the one and only Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire, the brilliant one, is our director of research. Our marketing director is a smooth and suave Dave Millar, and Spencer Gill is our research assistant.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, local public radio in San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Thank you.